Welcome to The Forest and the Trees, Global and Local Perspectives on the Environment, with your host, Melinda Tuhus. For this week's show, I'm going to be speaking with Denise Savageau, who is president of the Connecticut Association of Conservation Districts. And Denise actually emailed me a week or two ago to say that there's something missing from the conversation about climate change and the climate crisis that we're in. And it's the connection between climate and the biodiversity crises. And I 100% agree with you, Denise, and I am guilty of the same thing, of kind of downplaying that. So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And we can talk about this. I noticed when the young people were doing their climate strikes back in 2019, a lot of them, when they talked about what their concerns were, a lot of them mentioned species extinction. It seemed to be something that they took in and experienced more than adults, at least in terms of, you know, emphasizing it. So I don't know if that's true across the board, but I definitely did notice that back, you know, a few years back. So just tell us, start by telling us what you do in this, the association, and then we'll get into talking about the biodiversity crisis.
Well, thank you. I'm president of the Connecticut Association of Conservation Districts. And the conservation districts, we have five of them in Connecticut. They're an organization that's actually set up under state statute. Out of the Farm Bill era, there's conservation districts in every state in the country. There's some 4,000, I should say some 3,000 conservation districts across the country, all looking at soil and water conservation. And again, coming out of the Dust Bowl era, a lot of the focus was on restoring our farmlands from erosion. But we also work a lot on water quality, watershed management, non-point source pollution, so starting with erosion and sediment control. But that has grown in terms of what we need to do. And we have a better handle on, you know, soil and water conservation and what we need to do. And really a big focus now on soil health. And that really brings us to this whole idea of, you know, how it ties into climate change. So that's the work that we do. Working on healthy soils, local food supply, watershed management, stormwater management. And we were very active in the Governor's Council on Climate Change, and they had some work groups that were under the Working and Natural Lands focused on our natural resources. And a lot of times that piece gets left out of the discussion. So we were very fortunate that the GC3 included that discussion. What we're seeing now, however, is that, well, we did that piece. It's almost like, oh, that they all did their reports. And now we're not seeing those reports moving forward into action as we are with climate change mitigation measures, primarily, you know, looking at renewable energy or energy efficiency measures.
Right. And I remember a lot of those GC3 meetings. Before we get more into the specifics of it, I'm curious, is the five districts, are they just purely geographical within the state of Connecticut? Is there anything interesting about them and if they differ in any way, or how is it cut up? How was the state cut up?
Yeah. So originally the districts, well, there were eight of them and they were on the county level, but we don't have county government, as you know. And so they redid districts, and they somewhat tried to go by watersheds, but also they had to be respectful of municipal boundaries because we work very closely with our local municipalities. So not quite on watershed boundaries, but a little bit. So we do have, you know, five districts. The Eastern Connecticut Conservation District takes care of all of Eastern Connecticut, basically from the northeast corner all the way down to the Sound. We have the Connecticut River Coastal Conservation District that I serve with, and that district is primarily generally what we would say, you know, the River Cog area, Council of Governments area, Middlesex County. We have the Southwest Conservation District that takes in all of the shoreline and the towns basically in southwestern Connecticut. And then we have the Northwest Conservation District, that is that whole northwest corner, another heavy agricultural area like Eastern Connecticut Conservation District is. And then we have the North Central Connecticut Conservation District, and that is primarily the towns along the Connecticut River, but on both east and west of the Connecticut River, that central corridor. And so we really take up, you know, looking at the state and doing a lot of watershed planning and looking at natural solutions to that. As you know, soil health is critical not only for growing food, but for, you know, cleaning our water and a whole host of other, you know, official, you know, beneficial things that they do from an ecosystem services perspective.
Right. And I remember my friend Bill Dusing from the Northeast Organic Farming Association talking for decades about soil health and how if you took a teaspoon of soil, it would have like 5 billion little creatures in it. I don't know if that's the right amount, but a lot.
A lot. And you're right. And it's like it has so many. And that's why when we're talking about biodiversity, although a lot of times there is a big focus on, you know, the megafauna, the polar bears, and some of the other species that are being impacted by climate change, kind of as, you know, the kind of the poster child or the poster species. One of the things we really need to focus on is that biodiversity in soils. So when we don't have healthy soils and we're losing these microbes and the macro invertebrates that do so much work for us, when we're losing our insects and our pollinator population because of climate change, we need the resiliency there. And that's where when we have this crisis that's coming together, we have got two crises. One is the climate change and one is the biodiversity crisis. So when we talk about climate change, you know, obviously we're talking about, you know, warming temperatures and what is the impact. And in a state like Connecticut, our impact is obviously higher temperatures. You know, we're looking at heat islands. We're looking at drought where we didn't have drought, but we're also looking at major changes to our hydrology, both from a flooding perspective, but also from a water quality and quantity perspective, from a drinking water supply perspective. So we really need to then think about our natural systems. What does nature do for us? How does nature help us with that? And then again, making this link between biodiversity and climate change, some of our most endangered ecosystems, you know, in a state like Connecticut, because of higher temperatures, are our water resource habitats. So for example, just a degree change in a stream temperature can impact fish populations and spawning capabilities. So, you know, we're really looking at that. And again, this relationship between climate change is impacting biodiversity, but to be resilient, to make sure we're sustainable, we also need this biodiversity. It's the biodiversity that, you know, like I said, is the biodiversity includes the decomposers, the shredders that give us the healthy soil so that we can be more resilient. You know, healthy soil, again, it's about food, but it's also about allowing water to infiltrate. So we have, you know, more resilience to drought. It allows for water to filtrate so that we have cleaner water. So we're dependent, and the impacts on the water resources from climate change are then, you know, really, really dependent on this healthy soil. So we have this back and forth going. And of course, when we're talking about healthy soils, it's about what's growing on top of it. So that's about maintaining our forests, right? So our forest ecosystems, looking at maintaining some of our climate moderators. And again, forest resources are climate moderators, but so is it wetlands. When we think about wetlands and what they do for us, they moderate, you know, the water, not the quality and quantity of water in our streams.
So it really encompasses an awful lot.
It encompasses a lot. And that's why, so there's a handful of us folks who are working with, you know, the Connecticut Land Conservation Council, Audubon Connecticut, Rivers Alliance. We are all getting together. We were all part of the Governor's Council on Climate Change, working in Natural Lands Group, and we helped produce some really important work, and we don't want it left behind as we're talking about climate change. So we're talking about climate change from that mitigation perspective, and nature-based solutions have a part of that. It's not just about, you know, energy. It's about carbon sequestration in our soils, in our forests, in our wetlands. But it's also about climate change adaptation and resiliency. It's about making sure we have clean air. It's about making sure we have clean water. It's about sure we have intact ecosystems and maintaining this biodiversity. And again, understanding that this climate change biodiversity is one that it's, you know, so dependent upon each other that we need to be tackling both crises at the same time. We need to be, look at this simultaneously and not say, oh, we got to take care of the climate change. We need to take care of climate change and biodiversity at the same time because they're interdependent.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts about why one has sort of taken a back seat to the other?
You know, I think there was such a focus on we need to, you know, we need to reduce greenhouse gas, and that we need, and that one of the ways to do this is to stop fossil fuels. And we do need that. And that was something people weren't focused on necessarily. So I think that there was a lot of emphasis on trying to get people to understand that. But I think, you know, in that process, we had to make sure that we don't forget the whole idea of negative emissions. And again, carbon sequestration, carbon storage in our natural systems. And also when we're talking about temperature, it's like, think about what trees do. You know, trees prevent heat island effects. Trees prevent or they, you know, provide shade in the summer. They provide windbreaks in the winter. We all know if we go into a forest in the summer, it's cooler. If we go into a forest in the winter, it's warmer than, you know, out on a hilltop or at the shore. So when we look at those moderating effects of, so it's not just the carbon sequestration, but they actually moderate our temperatures. That's really important when you're talking about that climate change is about temperature change. So we need those natural systems that moderate our temperatures. Really, really important. And then I think there is a big focus on mitigation. Again, how do we stop climate change? But one of the things we have to remember is it's changing already. We know that. We haven't stopped it. And even if today, if we snapped our fingers and met our greenhouse gas emissions goals, climate would continue to change because we've already put that much into the atmosphere. That means we have to be thinking about adaptation. We have to be thinking about resiliency. And that's why we have to be thinking about nature and these natural systems, the ecosystem services provided by our soils, our forests, our farmlands. You know, our wetlands, both our inland wetlands and our tidal wetlands, are just critical, and we need to protect these. And sometimes I think we've kind of, understandably in some ways, that we, you know, a focus on the mitigation piece, but we're far enough into this discussion that we need to take this deep breath and say, wait a minute, let's have this. And you're seeing this on an international level. Internationally, they're basically saying, whoa, we need to really be looking at, again, this dynamic between climate change and biodiversity. And we need to be having that at the state level and at the local level.
Right. I've been working on a effort to stop a frack gas pipeline that, you know, is, again, a way to mitigate, because if we don't build it, well, you know, when we don't start sending frack gas through it, that that's one less source of, you know, climate pollution. But in West Virginia, this is the Mountain Valley Pipeline that is scheduled to go through 300 miles through West Virginia and southwestern Virginia. Some of the most beautiful and steepest parts in the whole country. So, because I've been down there a number of times and seen it and seen the devastation that it's already caused. But there are three endangered species would be that only exist, you know, in a pretty small geographic area that would be impacted by this. And it's two little fish and a a bat. And some of the, you know, things that people talk about when they're trying to stop it is, you know, well, you know, these critters need to, they deserve to live. So, you know, there's connections there. But what do you think about, there's the nature-based solutions, and then there's this thing called CCS, carbon capture and sequestration, where a lot of fossil fuel companies want to do this. And partly if they can capture the, you know, the carbon, then they can inject it into the ground and get more oil and gas out of the ground. So, but it's being subsidized along with, you know, a lot of clean energy. There's a ton of money in the IRA.
And there's a lot of dollars in there for nature-based solutions also. So I think when we're looking at carbon and saying we're going to, you know, capture it and put it back into the ground, and it's like, that costs money. We know that the cheapest way to store carbon is to do it naturally in the soils, naturally keeping our forests as forests, you know, naturally keeping wetlands. Wetlands have highly organic soils, both inland wetlands as well as tidal wetlands. And we know they have big carbon stores. Similarly, our forests have big carbon stores. And a lot of measurements in New England have been about carbon stores above ground for forests. But we know that below ground in the soils and that extensive, you know, root system where the carbon is and where the decomposers and the shredders and the microinvertebrates all are, this is a huge carbon sink. So one of the things when we're talking about natural systems or nature-based solutions is we know that they're less expensive than trying to say like, oh, we can engineer our way out of this. And we have found that with stormwater management. Stormwater management, we can engineer it, or if we really want to have clean water, we can protect the forest in the public drinking water supply watershed. And I'll just give you an example. New York City was going to have to spend, I forgot what the, if it was in the, it was in the millions of dollars, it may have been close to $1 billion to upgrade all of their water treatment facilities for the public drinking water supply for the city of New York. What they realized is that if they protected the water quality, if they protected the watersheds by keeping forests as forests in the watersheds that provide the water supply for New York City, and they did it conscientiously and made sure that there wasn't land conversion to other uses that would degrade the water quality, that they wouldn't have to spend that money to upgrade their systems. So they actually have invested more dollars instead of putting in a treatment plant and doing an engineered solution. What they did was they invested in keeping forest in forest and protecting the forest. And they have the economics that was done. The economic analysis is amazing on what they have done. So that's just one example. And we know in the state of Connecticut, we have the same thing. Investing, keeping forest in forest does so much for us. We're talking about protecting our airsheds. We have an air quality problem, particularly in the northeast, excuse me, along the southwest corridor, you know, I-95 corridor, right? Going up through Hartford. We know we've got an air quality problem. Well, trees help with that, right? We know we've got a water quality problem, protecting our watersheds. Again, keeping forest as forest. And again, the carbon sequestration piece of that is just really, really important. So, and we need to make sure that we're focused on that and looking at that. We need to talk about it from even the local level. Plan of conservation and development. The local municipalities have a plan of conservation and development. We need to encourage them to look at these natural systems and how do we protect them, start protecting them at the local level. If I want to make sure that I don't have flooding, I need to protect that watershed because protecting that watershed means keeping the trees, keeping those wetlands intact, keeping those riparian zones intact. It's not just about water quality. It's about water quantity. If we don't want flooding, we need to get water infiltration. If we want to have water for public drinking water supply, we need water infiltration to protect us during those droughty times. So when we think about those swing things we're seeing happening where one minute we're in drought in the state of Connecticut, and the next minute we're flooding. And so we're seeing this, going back and forth, going back and forth. And that's where intact forest, intact wetlands is just so critical, from that, from and the ecosystem services they provide, it's just so critical. And more so now that we have, this climate change. They've always provided, nature has always provided us with these natural services, but they're even more critical now that we're dealing with climate change.
Right. I'm part of a group in my town in Hamden called the Hamden Alliance for Trees. And we're all about, trying to protect the trees, trying to, talking about all the advantages of trees that, we've already talked about a little bit here, like helping with heat islands and, just helping with diverse biodiversity. If you have trees, especially oak trees, you have a lot more critters living in your yard. And it's so much more soothing than, if you have just sidewalks and paved streets, and cooler. And I'm also on the board of Urban Resources Initiative in New Haven, which has planted 10,000 trees and counting, on, on the strip between the sidewalk and the street. And we're trying to plant, we usually plant 500 a year, but we got a grant that to plant in specific areas that are that have less tree cover, which are pretty much basically, lower income neighborhoods. So this year we're hoping to plant 1,000 trees. So we have to, find people who want to have their have trees in their front yard. But most people, do. I mean, it helps with property values too. So I just wondered, is there any legislation that you're supporting in Connecticut this year that would help help reach your goals?
Yes, so we have some legislation that, as you know, there's going to be a comprehensive climate change legislation package coming out. And we were fortunate, our little coalition of the folks who worked on working in natural lands with the GC3 got together, and we worked very closely with the Connecticut League of Conservation Voters, Lori Brown and her team, to make sure that, as you saw, we were on a panel at their summit, and we are now looking to have a couple of initiatives be part of the climate change package. So the climate change package will have some of the stuff on energy, renewables, energy efficiency, all the things we expect to be in a climate change package, but also talking about negative emissions, how important that is, and making sure that we have some work in their own negative emissions, but also looking to form a advisory board task force type thing, really looking at these nature-based solutions so that we can come up with some comprehensive tools and any other potential legislation moving forward on, using natural systems in this climate change mold. What we really want to do is make sure we bring up those reports that were done from the GC3 and say, what's the best pieces out of them? How do we now turn these into legislation? So we're very encouraged that this has been received and is going should be part of the whole overall climate change package that we're, moving forward.
Great. Well, we've pretty much run out of time. These always go so fast. And I just, before we end, just ask you, where can people go who want more information about these issues?
So certainly they can contact the Connecticut League of Conservation Voters. They have a couple of fact sheets on these. One is called Nature-Based Solutions for Resilient Connecticut. There's also one called Healthy Forest, Nature Resilient Solutions. So they have produced a host of fact sheets. There's another fact sheet on riparian zones and riparian buffers. So those are the pieces of legislation we're looking to move forward and the programs we're looking. So that's probably the best place to do that. And then folks can always contact me. Denise Savageaud, and my email address is dmsavageaud at msn.com. Again, that's dmsavageaud at msn.com. And I'm happy to answer questions and direct you to where you need to go.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Denise. I'm really glad you reached out because this is a topic that's really important, and it's good to get some information about what's going on in Connecticut.
All right, well, thank you so much for your time and good luck with all the work you're doing as well.
Thanks. You've been listening to The Forest and the Trees, Global and Local Perspectives on the Environment with your host, Melinda Tuhus. Listen every second Saturday of the month at 9:30 a.m. here on WPKN 89.5 FM. For more environmental news you can use.
Thank you.